On Monday, October 24th, municipal elections were held in Ontario. On Thursday, October 27th, we decided to perform a postmortem of Guelph's election. Why was there such a low voter turnout? What makes a successful campaign? What sorts of challenges will the councillors face in the next 4 years? Our guests include James Gordon, soon to be formal councillor for Ward 2, Adam Donison, Guelph's hardest working journalist, and Susan Watson, Guelph's hardest working political pundit.
Good morning on Thursday, October 27th, 2022. Ontario's municipal elections were held on Monday, and today we'll be doing a post-mortem. As we gather, we are reminded that Guelph is situated on treaty land that is rich with Indigenous history and home to many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people today. We are meeting on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabeg and Haudenosaunee people and the treaty lands of the Mississaugas of the Credit. For tens of thousands of years across Turtle Island, Indigenous people have been managing the land, water, and wildlife responsibly by making decisions that take the long view of seven generations into the future. Guelph has a new city council. May their decisions be informed by the seven generation principle. So, who is on Guelph City Council? Well, we've got the usual suspects: Dan Gibson, Rodrigo Galler, Phil Ault, Christine Billings, Kathy Downer, Leanne Caron, and Dominique O'Rourke. Who are the new faces? Aaron Caton, Carly Klassen, Michelle Richardson, Linda Busatil, and Ken Yi Chu. And Cam Guthrie was handily re-elected as mayor. For the first time, the women outnumber the men. This should result in a new dynamic on city council. Our guests today will share their thoughts on this election. We've got James Gordon, the soon-to-be ex-councillor for Ward 2, Adam Donaldson, Guelph's hardest working journalist, and Susan Watson, tireless advocate for a better Guelph. Now we're going to start off with discussing the so-called slate. Were there a bunch of councillors that were part of a slate in this election? And I'd like to turn it over to Susan Watson so that she can give us her opinion.
So Slategate was a bit of a scandal in 2018 when Guthrie was actively promoting certain candidates, going on the doorstep with them, lots of social media, like clearly promoting specific candidates, which is not generally like a done thing to do for the mayor, that the mayor, because they're working with so many people, usually remains neutral. And I know a number of councillors run their campaigns that way. So Slategate happened in 2018. Adam observed, like in one of his columns, that Guthrie wasn't just campaigning against challengers. Guthrie was clearly campaigning against certain councillors and tried to throw them out under the bus by claiming that they had voted down and desperately needed housing. Two out of three applications, Adam fact checked for us, that Guthrie had voted against himself. So clearly Guthrie was very invested in who he got in. And I think as we go through the wards, like there are a number of people who had very clear links. And there did, you know, it seemed to me that there was some coordination, that there was some sort of coordination to get people to run in certain wards, to provide them with resources and to back them up. And so like I have my opinions on that and I can hypothesize, but I'd be interested to hear observations and hypotheses from other people too. Like, was there a slate? And if so, did Guthrie have a slate? And if so, who were those candidates? And did they get in?
Adam, would you like to comment?
Sure. Well, Susan quoted me, so I won't quote myself. But the thing about slates is, there is some behind the scenes tinkering. And it isn't even like a conspiracy. It's like it wasn't even hidden. Like Raymond Sartor said in my my candidate survey that Cam asked him to run, and he did. So, you know, that's not skullduggery when it's out in the open. Sure, I mean, there were certain candidates who would probably be more, I guess, friendly to some of Cam's ideas. Ultimately, though, this would be the second election where that kind of essentially blew up. And I mean, if it is like an organized effort, and maybe this speaks to the fact that there's like never any real competition in the mayor's race, that, you know, we can focus on council and who's aligned with who. But given who got elected, I kind of doubt anyone from any proposed slate ended up on council. I think the five new people are kind of really individualistic, and at least four of them, I would say, actually maybe not four, but at least three of them, I would say, might be actively antagonistic to any strong mayor agenda that Cam might have. But yeah, it's kind of tough to say. I mean, I would say at the end of the day, there at least a couple of people revealed that there was some kind of electioneering behind the background. I would not say, number one, it was an effective conspiracy, or number two, that, I don't know, that it just, it was coordinated in any kind of serious way. I think it's one of those, like, we'll throw the pitch and we'll see if it flies over the plate. And, you know, if not, if somebody dings a piece of it and it gets flied off into left field, then I'm doing sports metaphors. That's how much road I've run out of here. So,
And also actively, but there was active or coordinated campaigning, I would say, against the challengers, like the front runners. So, you know, there was promotion, and then there was coordinated attacks, or Guthrie throwing particularly progressive incumbents under the bus. So there was kind of campaigning, positive and negative campaigning around that, was my observation.
I mean, it's what Cam has done in the past, where it makes very oblique references to certain people who get in his way. But I'm not 100% sure we can say that there was like an active effort to undermine certain people. There are like little hints here or there, like the Sartor thing, or Denise Renaud, who ran in Ward 1 and then switched to Ward 5, that make you raise an eyebrow. But it was a sloppy effort, if it was an effort at all.
Right. James, do you have something to say about this?
Certainly, and thanks. I think there is actually some fairly obvious signs of a slate. One of them, which was, I don't know how deliberate it was or how obvious they were trying to make it, but several of the candidates who would be considered part of a slate looked like they all went to the same printer and got a deal on graphics and had the same designer, same messaging. And I think it's the same messaging this year emerged that came last time, both from Mayor Guthrie, and we heard it quite a bit from Driveway Dan Gibson, who were looking, their desire was to have a like-minded council. That came up last time, that came up again this time. And what that is, to me, is a euphemism for, we don't want rebels on council. We want to have, pro-developer, like-minded, as Morgan just said. So that wasn't, as Adam said, that wasn't hidden. However, I think Adam's also corrected, I don't think Guelph likes that. For the second time in a row, it wasn't really successful. And yet, we need to discuss what successful means, because some of the candidates that may or may not have been part of a slate, but at least had empathy for the ambitions and the policies of the more right-leaning side, some of them, we're fortunate that they didn't win, but they did all right. So yeah, there was some really extreme candidates that got like more than 1,000 votes. And that means that there are two Guelphs to me still. And that disturbs me. The Guelph that most of us in this meeting know and love, I think prevailed. I think we have a dynamic, progressive council. And yet there's that soft underbelly that if that kind of support from candidates that were clearly unqualified, not very capable, not engaged, if they still got that support, then there's concerns for me.
So I'd like to jump in for a second, because we're talking about a slate, and maybe it's time for party politics at the local level to be, to have party politics at the local level, like many other places around the world. And the reason I say this is a slate can be more efficient, and it doesn't necessarily have to be what we don't want. For example, Toronto very clearly had a slate and they elected a very progressive council. So it seems to me that a slate has its pros and its cons. And furthermore, it does reveal, like you just said, James, what is Guelph made of? So if anyone would like to comment on that, I would love to hear.
I actually, as someone who ran twice as a member of a political party, ran provincially, I've appreciated the nonpartisan aspect of being on council. Setting aside those party affiliations, you still would have you still represent the values and some of the policies that those parties of choice were representing. But being able to set that aside, I think, made for valuable debate. And sure, you'll get, when we say that we have a progressive council, we can say that perhaps there are seven councillors who you could also say are like-minded, except that they are single-minded too. I don't think they're guided by a leader, which often is associated with party politics. There's collaboration potential. They'll speak to each other and they'll bring forward the values that they think best represent the values of the people that voted them in.
Okay, I'd like to actually ask Phil his opinion because he was elected.
Thanks, Tanya. I'm going to take a contrary point of view on this. What's wrong with a slate? Is this about a slate or is this about a personality? There's a series of principles that were presented by a number of candidates, and everywhere else in the world at the municipal level, there are party politics. Maybe it's time that Ontario join the rest of the world so that the slate becomes transparent and we know what the series of principles are that a particular group is running upon. This is something that I think we need to get out of the realm of the personality. There will be more personalities and there will be more manipulations and there will be more efforts by developers and anti-developers in every election. The issue is transparency, and party politics would provide a greater capacity for transparency everywhere in the province. The reason we don't have slates is because a long time ago, a provincial government recognized that that was the foundation for challenges at the provincial level. It's what the People's Party of Canada recognized in the trustee elections, that if they could put, quote, anti-woke candidates in place, they were doing exactly what Trotsky used to say, which was basically continue the permanent revolution and make certain that you've got your cadre of individuals in place at the community level if you want to take over the country.
Yeah, so Phil, you're saying that the trustees did have a slate in that, well, the anti-woke list of trustees were very transparent with regards to what their slate of candidates would be. This is what I'm hearing from you, and and that progressive candidates were not doing that, and maybe that's to their detriment. Adam, I saw that you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I do find Phil's point to be persuasive, although I think some of the people who identify as anti-woke would have a heart attack being thrown in with Trotsky. but I think what this comes down to is this transparency issue Phil was talking about, right? You know, if Cam wants to cherry pick, or any candidate wants to cherry pick, like, these are the people I'd like to serve on council with, great, fine. Just be open about it. Be transparent about it. Don't do this skullduggery thing. It's like, ooh, I was just out and about, and here's this person who kind of politically agrees with me. We were campaigning together. We were hitting houses together. It was a wacky coinkydink. Was it? No, of course it wasn't. And, you know, when you make oblique comments like, you need to give me a council that's going to, like, agree with my agenda, like, maybe that's not so oblique, but, you know, that kind of thing. I think, number one, it's not transparent, like Phil said. And number two, it doesn't necessarily promote the ends that you as a candidate want, because you're trying to do this under the wire. You're trying to do it in the shadows. As for, like, the party aspect, I'm not 100% behind the idea of having, even if it's like city parties kind of thing, although I would agree it'd be nice for a lot of candidates to have the resources of a full political party. That might help with a lot of candidates who don't have a lot of means to run, but then you're also bringing in the whole party machinery too, of like vetting candidates and trying to find the best candidate for the ward or the district or whatever. So maybe there's a middle ground here, because I could see the merits of both arguments.
Tanya, if I could offer a historical perspective, Susan worked with me, and there's some other people that were involved with the Guelph Civic League years ago. We were accused of promoting a slate, and yet what we felt we were doing was allowing the public to be the most informed voters they could by describing the voting records of incumbents and looking at platforms of contenders to find out what their values were, and suggesting that those values, if we highlight those values, voters could make up their own minds as to whether those values aligned with what they were looking for too. So in some ways that could be considered a slate, and yet there wasn't the organization too among the candidates. However, one thing that I was concerned about this time was, at that same time with the Guelph Civic League, there was a concerted effort to make sure that there were not too many progressive candidates running against one another in each ward, which would split the vote. And I had that concern about that, because that effort wasn't made that often. But yeah, so it's hard to know what the definition of slate was, but I like what Adam says about, if there is one, make it transparent. I have a strange anecdote someone shared with me, another candidate just shared with me last week, where they asked Councillor Gibson if Ty Mack was part of his slate, because there was a well-distributed picture of Cam and Dan and Ty publicized. And Dan actually said, oh no, I think Ty Mack just photobombed that shoot. We didn't invite him to take part in it.
So I would just say, having worked on Karen Farbridge's campaign in 2014, that Ty Mack was one of the most vicious attack dogs on social media on Karen in 2014. So at that point, he really came across as part of Cam's team in that particular election. So, or at least a very strong ally. I can see Adam waving his hand, so maybe he has a different perspective. But I recognized his name before he ran, because just he was so, so vicious in 2014.
And I recognized Ty's name too. He was kind of a co-participant in a website in the last election called Guelph Local, which sold itself as a news site, but its news was essentially aggregating press releases and then publishing, you know, pro-Ford, pro-conservative editorials. The thing about Time Mac is I'm willing to side with Dan on that, because if you look at the picture, Time Mac is like just right in frame. And it was at the McDonald's opening. So that drew a lot of attention, period. It's like pretty early in the campaign, and Ty's pretty savvy with the social stuff. So I don't want to besmirch Dan. I know he doesn't have a lot of fans in this panel, but you know, it really did smell like Ty taking advantage of a situation. And I think by the end, Ty was kind of so extreme as presented in my articles and the Tribs articles and today's articles and just like general discourse on in the community, no one would want him on their slate.
Thank you. I would just like to say that Time Act brings diversity to council. And that's something this group has talked about a lot. Goler brought diversity to the council. And 4 years ago, he was accused of being a slate with Cam, okay, as part of the slate. And Goler, I'm sure, disappointed the heck out of Cam because he's his own man. And he did a really good job as a counselor. Ty Mack sounds like he's going to be his own man. We may dislike the politics. At the same time, this is what municipal politics is all about. And I really think we should stay away from parties and the organization and allow individuals to come forward and bring diversity to council. That's just my point.
Thank you, Ted. It's a very interesting one, because one point that has been made is that people want diversity, but the kind that they would like. Anyway, so Susan, you wanted to go, we start with Ward 1.
One thing I will observe, I looked at the 2018 results, I have them in front of me here, and the 2022 results. So Dan got 3,033 votes in 2018, and then dropped to 2,375. So a drop of over 600 votes. I don't know, you know, there was overall drop in voter turnout. There were changes to ward boundaries, but it was interesting to me that his like actual number of votes dropped. And then Aaron.
And can I interrupt for one sec? Can you tell me the percentage that Dan had?
So yeah, so in 2018, his percentage was 23%, was basically 24% of the vote. And then in 22, it was 31%. So he had a larger share of the votes that were cast. But it's just interesting to me, like, I think there may also be a difference between drop and rise in voter turnouts in the wards. I'll be interested to see that, you know, if that information becomes available. Erin was out of the gate really early. She was someone who had delegated at council. And I think, you know, it's the theme that we'll see across the wards. The key ingredients were money, organization, and sheer hard work. Because I think Erin knocked on just about every door in the ward. So, you know, I think she got her funding in place early, extremely organized, and just went hard the whole time. And again, you know, given some of the controversies around Ty, I'm also fascinated that Aaron won it with less than 200 votes spread between her and Ty. So I recognize Ty's diverse views. They could have a negative impact for a number of groups in a leadership position. So I was definitely surprised by how close Ty came there.
I was going to actually ask Tracy, if I'm not putting you on the spot, if you had any comments with regards to this election. And if I am putting you on the spot, then I'll come back to you later.
No, that's fine. I have to run soon. I have to drive my grandkid to school. So I was about to duck out before you put me on the spot. But I know I'm very openly part of Guelph and District Labor Council. I'm also the president of OSSTF-PSSP, the Mental Health and the Speech and Language Workers. District 18 is our district in Upper Grand. District 18 Political Action did some big actions. They sent emails to all of the trustees and all of the candidates asking about their support or lack of for school boards and school programs and mental health and violence in schools. And then the Labor Council, Tim Mathieson is amazing, did the same thing with a Labor Council slant. Does that make sense? And I also, from a mental health in schools slant, sent emails and asked questions of all of the candidates. So I was informed. But many, when I shared things on social media, many people from the backgrounds of my life said, I saw you supported X, why? And who should we support? And why do you support them? And where can we find that information? A lot of what I heard over and over and over is, I didn't know there was a mayoral forum / debate. I don't think it was really a debate, but, or I didn't know that I could send a letter to the trustees. Like, I think the whole lack of information was probably contributed hugely to voter turnout. I think there's a lot of apathy. People think it doesn't matter. But I also think that not being able to find the information, my neighbor behind me said, how do I find out anything about trustees? I haven't seen anything. And I'm like, well, that's a problem. I actively went searching for it. And I belong to some groups who actively searched for it. But if you weren't an active searcher, literally, I told my husband when we went in, this, and this is who you're voting. And that is how he voted, because I did the research, but I couldn't get to everybody's husband.
Tracy, do you have any like a 30-second list of solutions to that? Like what would help solve that? And how has this election been different from other elections?
So I did hear somebody posted earlier about I think it was a social media group, Guelph Action, which really promoted. I think it would be great to see a non-biased, full, I mean, it's hard because the people who don't agree with things don't work together, but a way for people to find that information easily and quickly. People, when you don't have information, I mean, my dad is 78 years old, and he said, that guy, John Bertrand, he has nice signs. Do you think he's a nice guy? And unfortunately, I think some people vote because I saw many signs with that name, or, I don't know. I don't know a solution. I don't know.
I just want to jump in here. Just quickly, I think that maybe social media does have a role to play in getting the word out. I'm not sure how good of a role it is. James, would you like to comment?
Yeah, I was a lot more involved in this campaign than I expected to be, since I wasn't running. And the reason is because I was barraged every day, people saying, I don't know about these candidates. How do I find out? And they said, who should I vote for? And I said, well, I'm not telling you who to vote for, but here's, I would pass on resources. So I think I would disagree with the suggestion that the information wasn't out there. What I would agree with is that it was hard to find because there was no central source. And a lot of the older voters were used to looking in their daily newspaper. They couldn't do that anymore. And they're not so savvy with social media. I have a proposed solution to run by you. I think, like, I was involved with a group called Get Involved Guelph that did some good disseminating of information, and there was quite a few of them, but it was helter-skelter. It's hard to find where it was. Why wouldn't, as a nonpartisan source, why wouldn't the city itself on their website, since they offered they offered the names and the websites and everything of all the candidates, why couldn't they say, okay, go to that website, and they would in turn say, here's all the resources that you need. It would keep it nonpartisan and would keep it centralized. And I think, and it would maybe be an excuse to improve the city website to, but there, yeah, there isn't a central go-to place, which left a lot of people scrambling for sure.
Adam.
Yeah, thank you. I don't want to sound like a Reaganite, but just in response to what James said, like, why does government have to be the solution? Like, I appreciate what James is saying, but I don't think posting sort of like the surveys and interviews by media advocacy groups on the city website is necessarily the answer. And I think the answer, and I've been thinking about this a lot in the last few days, because I've noticed some people in the chat talking about voter turnout or lack thereof. I think it's going to have to be like a whole community education effort starting like yesterday. Setting up a table at the mall, setting up a table at the farmer's market, setting up a table wherever large numbers of people gather, like festivals, hillside, wherever, and saying, tell me about what you know about city government. How do you find out information about city government? Do you know who your councilors are? Do you know who your trustees are? It's going to be shoe leather. It's not going to be, I appreciate the work that GIG did and other groups tried to do, but you can't just throw up a website, throw up some links and go, there you go. And to what Tracy said about non-bias, unfortunately we live in an era where even if you say you're non-biased and you conduct yourself in a non-biased way, nobody believes you don't have a bias. The other thing, I've been making some notes as people have been talking, so I'm just going to run through them quick. The sign thing, that's a big problem. Not the signs themselves, although maybe environmentally speaking, but in school board races especially, and then where I live in Ward 4, there were a couple of candidates for Ward 2, 3, 4 who had signs out, a lot of signs out, but they had no web presence. They had no campaign literature. They had no policy. And the one guy who did have a website on his sign, it took you to like one of those, here's a slate of anti-woke candidates running in all the cities that you can vote for sites. And then to what James said about newspapers, I mean, this is one of the reasons why one of the mayoral candidates giving out druthers was so insidious, because that's going to appeal to a generation of people who remember going out first thing in the morning, picking up the newspaper, except this newspaper is full of, that was dropped on many a doorstep in the city, was full of like just factually misleading information and incorrect information and conspiratorial information. And so if we don't start, this is why it comes around to like sort of a wholesale education effort. If we don't show people and explain to people how they can get the best possible information, we leave a lot of our citizens open to that kind of proselytizing. Just, we're going to dump something that looks like a newspaper on your front door, even though it's not giving you the news.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think of is we learn many things in school. And one of the things we don't learn is municipal literacy. Let's put it that way. Phil, I believe you had something to say, and then we'll go to Susan.
Yeah, but first of all, I clarified what the Druthers. Druthers was a newspaper that was delivered by a mayoral candidate. I actually have questioned whether it's even a legal campaign brochure. I think it might exceed campaign regulations because it costs too much, if you want the truth. It was distributed right across Canada, and it was distributed by anti-woke individuals. So it's an interesting point. But to Adam's point about shoe leather, I didn't want to get into my own campaign, but I want to be quite clear about a couple of things. I did not use any social media advertising at all. And I do want to say that I do believe that the best way to get out a message and to familiarize people with a candidate is at the door. Knocking on doors and having an effective brochure is far more important than a 2-second ad on Facebook. I think you're wasting your money. It requires people to actively search you out if that's what you want to do, or just presume that because you have a Facebook ad, you're a good guy. And by the way, the reason I use guy is the only ads that I saw were from guys. So I think we need to be really careful about social media. I think it's a waste of money for the most part. I don't think you get the bang for the buck. I think it looks sexy. And the proof of that, I think, are two candidates, Ty Mack and Rob Osborne. They have each about 25,000 people on a couple of local Facebook feeds, and they didn't win. Rob Osborne lost quite ceremoniously. Ty Mack nearly won, but I suspect that there are things in the background that led to that. So I think we need to be somewhat careful about that, especially if we want to continue the principle of solid community-based progressive principles. You can't get them from an ad on Facebook. You can get them by selling people on a series of ideas. And that's what the Guelph Civic League did in spades. It presented principles and values and worked hard over 4 years to do that. And it was successful.
So face-to-face, in mano-a-mano, conversation it sounds like the best way to go about getting your message across. Susan.
Yeah, I just wanted to express my profound disappointment that the Guelph Mercury Tribune didn't publish any mayoral or candidate profiles as in print, as far as I saw. They were up on the website, but they weren't in print. And then there was this column in the final edition that said, oh, well, the reason we didn't want to put it in print is because if we got something wrong, it's only printed every week now, and the print cycle means that it can't be corrected, and that could incorrectly influence a vote. And I just thought, I'm not buying that. Like, the deadline for candidates to file was, what, August 19th or August 20th? And the surveys could have gone out then, and those profiles could have been published in September, because I, you know, or through into October, because I think, you know, I've been hearing the same thing. Like, the information, yes, it was out there online, but it was laborious for people to find it. And I think, some of the older voters, not everyone is online. And just to have, oh, there's my copy of the Trib. Here are the Ward 3 candidates and what they're saying. Like, I just think that was a really important piece that we were missing this year. And I'm really disappointed in the Mercury Tribune. And I don't buy that excuse that they put in that column.
I don't buy that either. I'm a person who would like to have all of the information in print in front of me, so I'm not flipping back and forth on my computer. Alex, I believe that you have a comment, and then we'll go to Ted.
I'm a skeptic. I'm just not at all sure that having a more engaged and better informed electorate changes the bottom line. I don't think it improves our government. And, you know, we've got a lot of politicians now who get elected by not saying anything and by not revealing what they plan to do. So I'm a skeptic. And that doesn't mean I see no value in having people better informed. You know, it seems to me that it's nice to have people feel engaged so that they actually try to change the process. I guess, though, my problem is whether that's an illusion, whether you actually can change the process or not, is a large question in my mind. Anyway, I just think right now everyone is saying, oh, gee, we get so few people out voting. We've got to do something about it. Well, maybe we do, but I don't think that necessarily means we get better local government.
Okay, thank you, Alex. Ted, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I just want to mention a couple of positives for the next 4 years. More women on council, I think, is something that will benefit us. We also don't have Toronto and Ottawa's super mayor. that's it, you know, the next 4 years will be sort of similar. I think the women will make a difference. And I like the fact that there has been a change. I will miss James Gordon. I really wish Morgan had gone on. At the same time, I'm really pleased with the woman that is representing Morgan too. So I'm overall happy with how Ward 2 made out. In any case, I think this is going to be an interesting council, and I think that's a positive.
Okay, thank you, Ted. There's so many people that want to say something. Adam, would you like to say something right now?
I just had a quick kind of round of some of the things I've heard. The Druthers thing is interesting because their subscription model is you give like, say, $9.99 a month, you get like 3 copies. It's kind of like a multi-level marketing scheme. It's like Tupperware, where the more you give, the more copies you get. So for like $80 a month, they send you 400 copies. So it's entirely possible that Druthers, for this particular mayoral candidate, was a vendor and not necessarily a donor. But I guess that will be reflected in the expenses once those are filed. To Phil's point about online, there was a student vote. They did a mock vote at area high schools. Both Ty Mack and Rob Osborne won in those student votes. And my impression is because young people are more online than your typical municipal voter. So that is something to consider, that as the youngs sort of age up and become voters themselves, perhaps that's worth noting. Add to Susan's point in the chat, the most number of women on council was 2006. There were 9 women. This election, there's now 8 women, or 7 women and 1 non-binary person. So, I mean, that's not bad either. So that's a little correction I wanted to add to Susan's correction in the chat. And the last comment I will make is to Susan's point about the Merck Tribune. I hear you, but they don't print that in Guelph anymore. It's a complete non, like the people who are in charge of putting that paper together have no, when Hassan Fratz died in January, I saw a lot of people online making the point, it's like, I can't believe his obit is on page 6 and not on the front page considering how big Linamar is. And my reaction was like, well, that's because the people who lay out the paper in Toronto and print the paper in Toronto have no idea who Hassan Fratz is or his relevance to Guelph. So, this is like a situation of the times where, I've taken it a little personally, some of the colored commentary about what the media is and isn't doing during this campaign. And it's just like, we're doing the best we can with like the exceptionally limited resources we have. And that's why I do accept their explanation at face value. It's just, this is hard. The changing media landscape and trying to get everything and cover everything. And when it goes out in print, you can't take it back. And I hate to say this, and I know a lot of people are going to hate hearing it. We have to be more online. I know a lot of people hate it. I know that it brings a lot of confusion. It makes an entirely new set of circumstances, but things aren't going to go backwards, guys. Like, nobody's going to come in and start a newspaper again. It's just, it's an online world, and we have to figure out how to navigate that as opposed to trying to wish and hope and spread magic dust that the Guelph Mercury is going to magically reopen again tomorrow.
Okay, fair enough, Adam. Before I go to you, Susan, I think James had a comment.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to first respond to something Alex said. Alex, I share your cynicism. However, I think we must hold some hope that an informed electorate would benefit our governance. For one specific reason, I often heard on the doorstep that people, and I'd always say, so are you going to vote? And usually they'd say yes, even though they weren't going to. But when often the reply was, why should I vote when it's the same people that get in every time? And the answer, of course, is it's because the same people vote every time. That's why the same people get in. So we need to expand our engagement with the public and to prove that their voice matters. And that's hard to prove these days with the way our governance is going. But I think we must get there. However, one hopeful thing, and I don't want to speak negatively about a colleague of mine. However, Ward 6 demonstrated, and we'll get there eventually, that that was a unique situation where an incumbent lost. And it's really hard to get rid of an incumbent. One of my reasons for not running again was to leave space. I think we needed new voices. So that means if an incumbent lost, it meant that people were actually paying attention and came to the conclusion that that incumbent was not serving them in the way they hoped they would be served with their leadership. So that means they were engaged, they were paying attention, they were looking for alternatives, and they were willing to do that instead of so many times people going into the voting booth going, oh, I recognize that name. I'm going to put my check mark beside that.
Thank you, James. I'm going to actually ask about, I'm going to bring up online voting, but first I'm going to go to Susan with her comments.
So just want to say, like, it's an open question, maybe for a whole other breezy breakfast session, but how has, you know, really the under-resourcing and the changing media landscape, like how has that impacted things like voter turnout and engagement? And something that I would observe is when the Mercury was printing 6 days a week, we had six editorials a week. We had two local editorials from Chris Clark. So we had eight editorials a week. We've, you know, basically Adam, yours is the only one. And it was kind of a color commentary, you know, when Cam became mayor, and one of the first things he did was to cut the funding for the integrity commissioner who had made a ruling against him as a counselor. Like Chris Clark was all over it. Like, why did the mayor do that? I've never seen that happen before. And so people, it wasn't just stuff reporting on what was happening, but what it meant. And I think it kind of makes politics interesting. It's like, you know, having your color commentary for sports, if I'm going to use those analogies, it makes it more interesting. And so I think that's a big part. About Ward 6, I am going to be so interested to see Ken Yi Chu's financial filing. When I met him at an event in August, he had already spent $12,000 on his campaign, and he was gunning to spend 20, which was, I think, the maximum for the ward race. And I have never seen a financial filing higher than, I think, 9,000 for a ward race. And that was Stacey Collison, who came in at about 9,000, I think, in 2018. And she was heavily funded by developers. So, you know, there, along with Aaron's campaign, I think there was a different level of professionalism with those two campaigns. Ken had a whole team, super slick website, you know, background in landscape architecture, going to study rural planning, and just really big ground campaign going door to door, you know, along with the signs and everything. So, you know, again, in my estimation, it's that combination of organization, money, and work. And I remember when I met him thinking, wow, like if Mark McKinnon doesn't pay close attention, he's at risk of getting picked off. And so I didn't know if it was going to happen, but I wasn't completely surprised when it did happen either.
Okay, thanks, Susan. I just wanted to circle back to the online digital question. In other municipalities, I would ask people, I would ask people from other municipalities, hey, have you voted yet? And I would often hear, yep, I voted online today. And my question to all of you is, with regards to online voting, there is no paper trail. So for me, online voting is a no-go. Now, this is different than online engagement, but how different is it really? Adam, you said that once a paper is published, you can't take it back. whereas online you can change stuff. I think that's actually a negative, that's a con towards online, because if you're doing your research properly, like newspapers used to do, and you're going to say, well, it's not like that anymore. But still, if you were going to, you would have to do your research properly.
I was going to say, we still do research properly.
That's not what I meant. I'm sorry. That's not, I know that I put that, I know that I didn't put that properly. I guess what I was answering is your comment about once it's printed, you can't take it back. That's what I was trying to say. And then once you vote online, that's gone. Like you can't, no one can even review those results. And that's what concerns me with regards to online. People don't really consider that. So that's just a comment on my part.
Well, let me respond to that comment. Just, you know, most news outlets like myself, if I publish something and somebody says, somebody sends me an email, says, no, that's wrong. You need to correct this. I will note that I've corrected an article. So, I mean, that's just a bit of procedure there. To your point about online voting, I mean, yeah, there's no paper trail, but this, I mean, the big problem with online voting is that there's no universality where you go to the vendor and it's like Interact, essentially. There are several different types of Interact machines, several different types of Interact companies. They all technically do the same thing, but like if you go, you know, you go shopping and you stop at store X, they have one type of Interact machine, and go to store Y and they have another type of Interact machine. Internet voting is a lot like that. So, you know, if in order to have a paper trail, I think that'd be a simple matter of I'm at home, I vote. And we see this like when we order stuff online, sometimes you get like if you want to print off a copy, and a lot of us probably don't, but it gives you the option. I think to fix it, you know, at City Hall, there's a printer, it prints off a so-and-so voted, this is the transaction number. It doesn't say who they voted for, but it prints off a thing that says so-and-so transaction number. Because, and I had somebody who works in tech explain this to me, online banking is, security for online banking is easy because you know how much money you have in the bank and the bank knows how much money you have in the bank. Online voting security is different because you know who you voted for, but nobody else should know who you voted for. So that's the tricky part. Now, having said all that, and I know this is not going to be popular with this crowd, we're going to have to get used to the idea of online voting. And it's not about convenience. I just think that in the last term, there was a very persuasive case made that the easiest, fastest, best way to get accessible voting for everyone is to have an online option. And that saves the Rinema rule of, we're going to get this technology and we're going to be the first ones to try it and so on and so forth. And maybe the last thing I'll say about this is for people who are like, we'll fix voter turnout with online voting. We won't. When we had online voting in 2014, turnout got as high as 43%, which is certainly better than 28. But it's not as high as 60, 65% you get in federal and provincial races, and there's no internet voting there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Adam. I appreciate you being a good sport with regards to my perceived Ludditeness with regards to online voting.
I just wanted to comment that I purposely went to the Evergreen Center on the voting day. And I was doing that because I just expected to run into friends and people and talk to people. And I was the only person there in the room besides the four returning officers and the people running the actual voting machine. And that was disappointing. By the time I left, there were five more people had entered the room. And that's what's wrong with all of this. Maybe if we reserved it for the voting day, and by then you'll have read two more Adam Donaldson's columns in GuelphToday.com. I wanted as much information as I could get before I voted. So if I'm voting online 2 or 3 weeks before the polls actually close. There's a lot of stuff I don't know at that point. So I am really in favor of voting on voting day. It was also a fabulous day to be out. And it could have rained, it could have been miserable, but it wasn't. I didn't get to talk to anybody besides the returning officers, though, and that was disappointing.
Well, Ted, you know what? I got in trouble from one of my relatives who berated me for not voting in advance. So I just said, well, you know, I vote on voting day just in case a candidate dies or kills someone.
Yeah, so Ward 2, James, you're going to have maybe a lot to say on this. So Rodrigo worked super hard. He, I think, started door knocking maybe in June, I think declared like as soon as he was allowed to, and just really worked really, really hard, ended up getting signs everywhere. And the results really showed that. So again, he got... Rodrigo got 2,728 votes in 2018, and then he got 3,498. So he grew his vote share by, what are we looking at? Like over almost 700 votes. So, you know, not everyone's votes went down. So I think that was, you know, I know the boundaries changed, but that was certainly, I would say, an endorsement of him as an incumbent, and you know, and also a response to the hard work that he put in campaigning. I was surprised with Carly Klassen. She pulled really high, like over 3,000 votes. So she declared extremely late, but seemed to go from 0 to 100 very quickly in her campaign, and clearly got incredible momentum. And I think in this particular ward, to me, it was pretty, my supposition is that Raymond Sartor, as Adam mentioned, and Rob Osborne were the kind of CAM affiliated slate. I know that Rob Osborne, I think, worked on the Royal City Stories with Dan Gibson. It was his media company who did that. So there was, you know, there was a political alliance there between, you know, Guthrie and Gibson, but both of them were quite quite far behind. But and I think it's very interesting, you know, the changed ward boundaries, I think, perhaps have made that a more progressive ward than it was previously. So that's my two cents on two.
I guess I, as the Ward 2 councillor, I should mention something. I was nervous because I wouldn't have been able to sleep for the next 4 years if I had retired from my seat only to find that a regressive candidate won. So I was pleased to see that I believe that we have two progressive dynamic councillors, and it sort of proves, demonstrates that, again, with the foot leather or online argument, Rodrigo and Carly both really were excellent at the doorstep. They had a really good manner and they really engaged with people. So I think that that hard work made a difference. And it also, I was delighted to see, I was worried about those dark candidates. And I'm only not referring to their politics with, you mentioned Sartor and Osborne, that they were quiet. So I didn't know whether they had a network or not that would elevate them, but I was pleased to say that they didn't. So I think that that theory, and I was speaking on a chat with Tanya about this, those candidates followed the conservative playbook, which was to not take part, not engage, not show up. And it didn't work for them. And I was relieved to hear that.
Thank you, James. Mike, would you like to comment?
Yeah, Ward 2. So I did work on Carly's campaign, and of course supported Morgan as well. But just wanted to, you know, yes, Carly did go from, she was a latecomer to the race. I think it was just a couple of days before the deadline that she submitted. However, you know, it might seem like zero to 100, as Susan was saying, in terms of her, you know, getting support. But I do want to highlight, Carly's got a lot of social capital out there. She runs a downtown business. And over the years, through Market, which is a essentially a pop-up market, and through her work at the farmer's market at 10C, she built a ton of goodwill with the community. So let's not underestimate that aspect. It's not just about the right policies, the right politics, the right team. I think Carly was really able to capitalize on her work in the community over the last few years, including her involvement also on the downtown BIA, the library board, as well as the Chamber of Commerce. So those, I think those really helped her in terms of capitalizing on election day.
Ted, would you like to say something, and then Susan?
Yes, just the absence of James Gordon, I think, allowed Goehler to come forward with more votes, and also allowed Cotton. And it can't be overestimated how important that was, that James opened up the riding by not being a candidate. So thank you, James.
Thank you, Ted. And Susan.
Yeah, I just want to make an observation. And again, James might want to weigh in on this, but when I do the mental math, and so James is mentioning that Carly was on the library board, so she really gets the library and how important it is. I think we now have the votes to know that it's very likely that whatever, like even if the bids on the library, as we're expecting them to come in above 62 million, given the inflationary environment, I think that we have the votes to make sure the library gets completed. I don't know where Michelle Richardson is going to stand. I fully expect actually that Kenyi Chu and Dominique might vote against a higher price tag for the library because they are going to stand for a South End rec center and they won't want to see resources siphoned away. But even if Richardson and Kenyi Chu and Dominique vote against the library, I think there's going to be a majority that's going to see this project through. And I feel a huge sense of relief about that, I have to say.
Yeah, if I can add to that, Tanya, I can speak as I'm a library board member for the next 2 weeks. I think this was a pro-library election. And the library actually should never have been an election issue.
Yeah.
The candidates that brought it forward and insisted on making it one, even though it's already a done deal, we've already had lots of votes on it, were misinformed about the risks of revisiting library. But I think our electorate recognized that. I think it was a definitely pro-library vote all around, and I was really excited and relieved to see that.
We have the votes. There are seven of them, excluding Ward 6. Linda Busatil is very pro-library. The candidates, councillors in Ward 2 are pro-library. Aaron Caton is, I am, and the councillors from Ward 5 are. That, so even if Michelle Richardson, which I think she is pro-library if I recollect, and the Ward 6 candidates were not to support the library, we have the seven votes. But the other thing, I wanted to make one other comment. More importantly than the library, sorry folks, is we now have people on our council who are quite prepared to take on issues of governance and procedure. And that's extremely important. We have been bogged down in bad process for 8 years, and that has led to some very sketchy decision-making, some of which I think can even actually put us in a precarious situation with regards to the law. Alex Smith might want to comment on that. Or also with regards to the fact that we tend to show favoritism towards certain developers, and other developers might ask us for the same regard because we decided essentially to suspend our rules for a couple of nonprofits. And I have nothing against those. But if somebody wants to make the argument that process has been misused. They do have a right to say they want to be treated equally. So Linda Busatil knows governance well. This is going to be good for council. And by her own admission, she will not back down. So I'm looking forward to that. Aaron Caton has told me the same thing. I'm looking forward to that. And that should empower our council to stand up to bad process that has belabored us for the last 8 years. Enough said by me. Sorry, Diane.
Thank you, Phil. James, would you like to comment on what the new council might be up against?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. I'm as cynical as Alex is about one thing, and that is in some aspects, I feel like I got out of there in time. It's going to be hellish for the new council to try to deal with the heavy-handedness of the provincial government, where why would you even want to be on a council that could be overridden easily and bypassed by provincial mandates? So that's going to be very frustrating. And I hope that those progressive councillors find the tools to be able to deal with that. I think even what I noticed, and it was my sort of last act on council, was bringing that strong mayor motion forward, opposing it. But I notice already that Ford has sort of put that aside and found new ways already to try to ram his agenda through, his pro-developer agenda. And he's got other tools up his sleeves, other tricks to make sure that councils can be bypassed with that. So I have the utmost empathy, but a fear that I don't want that job to become irrelevant because of that heavy-handedness.
Thank you, James. I've got Adam, and then Mike, and then Susan, please. Adam.
Thanks, Tanya. I was going to launch into a similar comment as James, that, yeah, I think, and with all due respect to issues, I think one of the problems with the fact that the library, and it was kind of surprising that they came back to haunt, considering I could count on one hand the number of delegates out of 5 meetings who came out to speak against the library last term. It robbed us of talking about some of the bigger issues of governance at council, and I've been kind of beating that drum myself. And yeah, it part of it too is like this whole what is it called, the build homes faster act or whatever the heck it's called. It's I can't remember the name of it. Hold on, I have it right here. More homes build faster, taste great, less filling. That's overrunning several key powers that the municipality has. Never mind the fact that it's saying we're going to build more homes, but we're going to gut the municipality's capacity to fund the infrastructure. So we're going to have a ton of homes, but no roads or water pipes or parks or supporting infrastructure, because we don't have the money for that. And because we're a city, we can't run deficits. But that's part of the thing. We kind of need a united council to stand against that kind of like regressive top-down provincial mandating. I hope that with as Phil's sort of implying, with a stronger, a council with a stronger governance hand, we might see more transparency, more openness, less closed meetings where council emerges with an entirely formulated motion that has no background information attached to it. These are small things, but you know, to me, it's a bit weird that council goes into closed session to talk about the PACE program, and it emerges with a PACE program, but no more Our Energy Guelph, which is the group that came up with the PACE program. That needs a vetting. I need information. And you know, that may not matter to 9 out of 10 voters, but I think the way that was handled, given the right or the wrong circumstances, will definitely make people pay attention when the worst case scenario happens. If we don't watch the small stuff, these things fester and get larger and become even more difficult to deal with. So I hope governance is a priority for this council.
Yeah, me too. Mike?
Sure, just wanted to weigh in on the library quickly. The right and Cam did raise a library and try to make it a wedge issue. It did work to the advantage of Carly. I did canvas with her People did ask questions about the library. She was unabashedly pro-library, and I think that the numbers show that there's support for the library. I think the Cam and company that thought it'd be a good wedge issue underestimated the effect of the pandemic. And I think the pandemic has reminded residents of what is important, which is parks, civic infrastructure, and a community. And I think that, I think the results reflect that as well. What's interesting about, the strong mayor's powers that we'll eventually see here in Guelph as well, is, as you know, right now, the legislation is limited to the city of Toronto and Ottawa, and Ford has strongly hinted by 2023, it will trickle down to the rest of Ontario's municipalities. The mayor, is, when you look at, the role of the mayor in our municipality in the last 30, 40 years, the mayor was, the position was mostly a consensus builder, and only when it was, time to break a tie would the mayor weigh in. That's, as you know, is in the, especially in the last, last two terms, that position is changed, right? Cam wants to be a kingmaker. And that's fine. But there's a real paradox there. So when Cam doesn't know which way the vote's going to go, you'll notice that he'll say, especially on social media, he'll say, well, it's the will of council. But when, he's sure that he's got support on his side, he will, basically push ahead of council or even undermine council's decision-making power. So a good example is yesterday on social media, when the issue of the Fife Road potential designation of that part of the tower, not the entire building, but just the tower of that building, that according to that nonprofit developer will undermine an affordable housing unit or even the entire project, depending on how you read it. Cam posted a pic of somebody demolishing a house saying, it's me, this is me. Like basically, do you actually want to work with council or not? So it really depends on the issue. So there's a real paradox there. And it's maybe time to call him out on that. I mean, of course, councils have called him out on that. But I think, maybe it's not a bad thing that we have strong mayor powers because basically, at this point, maybe we'll notice that the emperor has no clothes. I don't know, but it's going to be an interesting 4 years.
So on the strong mayor's power, I really question whether Guthrie will be able to use them. So if Guthrie vetoes a majority decision of council, he will need 5 votes, including his own, to overturn a challenge to his veto. And really the only core allies he still has on council are Dan Gibson and Christine Billings. And so who out of the new, and he's burned a lot of bridges with the incumbents he threw under the bus. So out of the people who are newly elected, who are those allies? And they could just be Michelle Richardson and maybe Kenny Chu. But I would say that there would be a huge political risk for any councillor who enabled Guthrie to use those strong mayor powers. So I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but the individual, like there could be huge blowback if the electorate isn't on board with that. And then the last thing I want to say is my prediction is that this will be the last election for Guthrie as mayor, that there will not be a challenger with council experience. We have 5 new faces on council in 4 years' time. They will have a term under their belt. They will not be untested. Rodrigo Galler and Domenico Roark will have 2 terms under their belts. There will be a challenger with council experience. Guthrie will not get a free pass like he did in 2018 and this election with people who aren't able to go toe-to-toe with him. That's my prediction.
Okay, thank you, Susan.
Let me just say, save this clip. Dominique's running in 2026 as mayor. save this clip.
Adam called it first.
Okay, so one more thing from a Representative Mike from GCAT. Mike, would you like to say your piece?
Sure, thanks, Tanya. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great, thanks. So GCAT, we published a list of responses from candidates to questions we put out on active transportation. And we got a fairly good response, but obviously a lot of candidates had tons of questionnaires to fill out at the time. However, we did publish it on social media as well. And we got slightly criticized that we didn't actually provide a voting record of candidates. They said, you know, candidates can say basically what they want during a campaign, but the true test of, you know, what their values are would be their voting record. So I thought to myself, well, that's easier for you to use, say, who's going to do all this work? But so I checked with the city clerk, and he agreed that it's a monumental task to actually go through all the minutes of every meeting. So what I'm wondering is, from this group here especially, surely during this age of electronic information gathering, there must be an easier way to actually access that information so that we can have something for the next election where voters can be much more informed and actually see what the voting records of the candidates were, and if they really truly voted with their values that they said they would vote with in the previous election.
I started that project at the beginning of the 2018 municipal term. It is so freaking hard. It is. It's especially when you get into like really contentious meetings where you have motions and amendments to the amendments, and then there's an amendment passed, then you pass the whole motion, and there's another amendment, there's an additional motion. And once you kind of get into this, it's a job in and of itself, trying to keep track of it all. And I eventually, I gave it up inside like three meetings. It was that hard. So I figured, you know, I try to do the best SEO I can so that people can find the topics and the information, and, you know, follow the blow by blow and see who voted for what. And that's not as easy as clicking on something and see who voted for what bike path or something like that. But yeah, it's a ton of work. I wish there was a techie way of making it easy. And maybe I'm just not techie enough. I can see that. I'm no Steve Jobs over here, but you know, it is a heck of a lot of work. And so I 100% agree with Mike. That would be an exceptional tool, and maybe someone out there might have an idea that can make it easier. I know I don't have one, so just to give that bit of information to people.
Okay, thank you, Adam. It would be an excellent resource if the city website was less difficult to navigate. I have found that when I can't find something, I email a city clerk to get information. Thank you to Susan, to Adam, to James for being here and answering our questions and giving your input. We really appreciate it. We really appreciate it. Speaking of municipal elections, you can have your say, give municipal election feedback. Did you vote? Where and when? Were you happy with the number of voting stations? So please do take this survey. And now I'd like to call on Juanita to give an announcement. Juanita.
Hi, everybody. Just quickly, we are starting to get some money coming in for the Alan Pickersgill soapbox, which is wonderful. We're almost at $1,500, but we have a budget of between $3,000 and $5,000. Checks can be made out to Alan Pickersgill soapbox and let me know and I can pick them up. And e-transfers are even easier at soapbox4alan@gmail.com. That's a soapbox number 4, Alan, A-L-A-N. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Juanita. And coming soon on Breezy Breakfast, we're going to be talking about the role of nuclear power in getting to net zero, growth in Guelph. I believe it's not 10,000 homes, but 18,000 homes by 2031. And then sort of part and parcel of that, how are we going to water 208,000 people in Guelph by 2051? And inclusive zoning, what does that mean for affordable housing? So thank you all for coming out this morning, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for joining on our post-election postmortem. See you next week when we meet four of our new councillors. I'm Jiayu, and I produce the Breezy Breakfast podcast. Breezy Breakfast, where the hot coffee fuels the fiery discussions.